PR. From WJF.
From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the latest on the New York State prison protests by corrections officers. Dan Hoos from Sullivan County Government is here with an update from Monticello, including the latest on the closure of the PepsiCo plant in Liberty, which will impact nearly 300 workers. As part of its 50th anniversary celebration, the River Reporter newspaper is working to address one of its biggest challenges, finding enough staff to cover the extensive geographic area of its readership. We'll speak to River Reporter publisher Lori Stewart about a news ambassador initiative aimed at closing the local news coverage gap. And Ralph Fasanella, the people's artist. Some of his powerful paintings are on exhibit locally, and we'll learn more about his art that sheds light on the everyday dignity of workers. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is praising his meeting this week with the Trump administration's special envoy for Ukraine and Russia. He says this restores hope. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv. President Trump has been attacking Zelensky.
In a video address, Zelensky praised the Trump envoy, Keith Kellogg, and said Ukraine needs strong agreements with the U.S. We discussed the need for a reliable system of security guarantees so the war does not return and the Russians do not destroy more lives, Zelensky said. We all need peace. Ukraine, Europe, America, the whole world. Zelensky said he and Kellogg also talked about a deal that would give the U.S. control over some of Ukraine's mineral rights in exchange for continued military aid. Earlier this week, Trump repeated Kremlin talking points attacking Ukraine and Zelensky lamented that Trump was living in, quote, a space of disinformation. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Senate has passed a budget resolution that would advance President Trump's political goals. The Senate was in session all night before adopting the measure, mostly on party lines. It calls for billions of dollars in new military spending as well as for border security. What's not clear is how Republicans intend to pay for these efforts. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer says middle-class Americans might be forced to cover the costs.
This debate is going to go on for weeks and maybe months. Democrats will be ready to come back and do this over and over again because Americans deserve to know the truth. And what is the truth? Under Donald Trump's Republican Party, billionaires win and American families lose.
The Senate is expected to put Trump's agenda items in more than one bill, but Trump does not like what the Senate is doing. He prefers the House version. House lawmakers are trying to shoehorn Trump's priorities into a single bill. Stocks opened lower this morning as the National Association of Realtors reported a slowdown in home sales last month. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled about 380 points in early trading.
Sales of existing homes fell nearly 5% in January compared to the previous month. The average sales price was just under $397,000. High prices and high mortgage rates have been a drag on the housing market. Freddie Mac says the average rate on a 30-year fixed home loan is now 6.85%. Mortgage rates have barely budged in the last month. Meanwhile, the number of homes on the market has increased. Stock in United Health Group is down this morning after a report that federal investigators are scrutinizing the company's billing practices. The Wall Street Journal says the Justice Department is investigating the way United Health bills the federal government for people on its Medicare Advantage plans. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 380 points. This is NPR. Authorities in Israel say one of the bodies handed over by Hamas yesterday as part of the ceasefire agreement is not the body of a hostage. The body of Shiri Bibas was supposed to be handed over yesterday. The bodies of her two young sons were positively identified, as was that of a fourth hostage. Israel's military says this development is a violation of the utmost severity by Hamas. Tomorrow, Hamas is supposed to free six living hostages. President Trump's advisor overseeing firings of thousands of federal workers through the DOGE entity has been celebrated. Billionaire Elon Musk appeared at an annual gathering of political conservatives outside Washington. It's known as CPAC. NPR's Stephen Fowler reports.
After Musk took the CPAC stage, Argentina's President Javier Milei brought him a chainsaw to symbolize his work to slash the size, scope, and spending of the U.S. government. Musk hyped the idea of taking some of that savings identified by Doge and giving it back to taxpayers.
It's money that's taken away from things that are destructive to the country and from organizations that hate you.
But that idea is a long way from coming to fruition. An NPR review finds the Doge effort has overstated its savings claims so far by billions of dollars. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Washington.
The NBA star Victor Wembanyama is out for the rest of the season. The San Antonio Spurs disclosed yesterday he has a blood clot deep in his shoulder. Experts warn in some cases such clots can lead to heart and lung problems. The Spurs say they're optimistic he'll make a full recovery. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is a special edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Erin Shear with Eating Upstate, where I...
Oh, apologies for that. We got a little bit of a technical difficulty here. That's not a special edition of Radio Chatskill. It's a regular edition of Radio Chatskill, and it's a Friday, and we'll hear from Dan Hoost in just a moment. I'm Tim Bruno, and want to start first with some restrictions on solitary confinement in New York State prisons that were lifted yesterday, and visits canceled on corrections officers carried on with wildcat strikes despite a judge's ruling. By Thursday afternoon, the walkouts had spread to 41 out of the state's 42 prisons. Patricia Rabayo reports.
The ongoing strike by correctional officers across New York State has now entered a new phase. Workers are still picketing outside facilities, including the Woodburn Correctional Facility in Sullivan County, demanding safer working conditions, better staffing, and an end to excessive overtime. The strike, which has impacted nearly 30 of the state's 42 prisons, began in response to what officers call dangerously unsafe working conditions. Governor Kathy Hochul has called the strike illegal under the Taylor Law, which prohibits public employees from walking off the job. In response, the state canceled visitations at all prisons and announced that the National Guard troops will be deployed to help manage the facilities. Now, new actions are being taken by the state government. Governor Kathy Hochul has signed an executive order authorizing the deployment of the National Guard and additional compensation for officers who return to work. Commissioner Daniel Martuscello issued a memo titled Path to Restoring Workforce, outlining key changes, including suspending certain elements of the HALT Act under exceptional circumstances, rescinding staffing restrictions to allow more flexibility, increasing overtime pay to 2.5 times the regular rate for working officers, also ensuring no disciplinary action against employees who return to work before the midnight deadline. The union representing the officers, the New York State Correctional Police Benevolent Association, has distanced itself from the strike, citing legal restrictions, but continues to mediate between workers and the state. Sullivan County Legislature has now passed a resolution urging Governor Kathy Hochul to revoke the HALT Act.
Our corrections officers are suffering. They are out there picketing with informational pickets. The HALT Act should be removed.
That's Nadia Reich, the chair of the Sullivan County Legislature, talking about the protest that's going on in Sullivan County. The HALT Act was designed to limit the use of solitary confinement, which has been a major point of contention among officers who argue it has led to an increase in violent incidents against staff.
They go into unknown, dangerous situations every day. Who are we protecting? Reinstate the 100% employment, the staffing, so that they are safe. If Governor Hochul really wants to protect everybody in the state, protect your corrections officers as well, so that they could see their families, that they don't have to work 16 to 24 hours a shift that is highly unsafe for them to do.
As the situation continues to unfold, all eyes are on how the state and the correctional officers will navigate this crisis. Will the new measures be enough to end the strike? Or will tensions continue to rise between the workers and the state? In Liberty, I'm Patricio Arroballo for Radio Catskill.
And joining us now is Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. He's the communications director and joins us every Friday. And so we heard there from Chairman Reich about her comments on what's going on at the prisons, specifically locally here at the Woodburn Prison, the correctional facility, joining these other state workers on a wildcat strike. What else has the legislature done, or what are they saying here in regards to this walkout and the HALT Act?
HALT stands for Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Solitary Confinement. It's not a perfectly accurate acronym, but that's what got put together there at the state level. Went into effect across the state in 2022. It limits the use of solitary confinement and does not allow solitary confinement for anyone over the age of 55 or under the age of 21, anyone who has a disability, and anyone who is pregnant. And corrections officers, of course, this is one of their big issues, is that they are countering that has made conditions, working conditions, far less safe, that they cannot, that they get assaulted, but that they could not confine these folks for those folks' safety and for the corrections officer's safety, and that sometimes these folks are again in close proximity to the officers even after the assaults have occurred. It's one of, I think, several issues that are driving these, I think what they're calling the wildcat strike. And that was what our chair, Nadia Reich, whose husband is a retired corrections officer, she was talking about yesterday. So we're going to be writing a letter to the governor and the state legislature and the commissioner of corrections supporting the calls to repeal the HALT Act and reinstitute 100% staffing levels in the correctional facilities rather than, I think what I've been told is it's about 70%.
Yeah, those folks are across the state striking, protesting forced overtime, they say, and dangerous conditions. And mm-hmm. part of the dangerous conditions, they said, are the elements of the HALT Act. The entire act was not suspended, but the commissioner of the state corrections office paused certain elements of that law, but they didn't say exactly which ones they were, saying, quote, "We are suspending the elements of HALT that cannot safely be operationalized under a prison-wide state of emergency until we can safely operate the prisons," end quote. So the legislature is going to advance the idea and support the idea of repealing the entire act.
Yes.
And how does this impact the Woodburn Correctional Facility locally, considering that facility was set to be closed? How does that?
No, Sullivan Correctional.
Sullivan. My mistake.
Woodburn remains open.
How does it factor into just the overall part of the legislature wanting to, be involved in this part of what's going on at the state level with these correctional officers?
Well, Woodburn, being a minimum to medium security facility, is probably not dealing with it to the extent that a maximum security facility will, and that's not to minimize it. I know that there are corrections officers who are protesting outside of Woodburn, as well as many other minimum medium security facilities across the state. The idea is that I think the legislature wants to say, we hear you. We support safe working conditions for you. I don't think the legislature wants to say that they don't support humane conditions for the inmates as well. And I would hope and think that the corrections officers would agree with that as well, that they want humane conditions. But the chair of the legislature, and it was agreed upon by unanimous vote by the rest of the legislature, feels that currently the odds are stacked against corrections officers. They are having a lot of overtime. I heard just the other day of someone who was working in one of the prisons from Sunday to today with no time off. It was basically 24/7, which I couldn't believe it. I think they got some rest breaks at the prison, but they weren't allowed to go home. So there are definitely issues that the state needs to address with the prison system. We're not saying throw out the whole system and what has some of the changes that have happened in the past few years to ensure there's humane treatment of those who are in there, but there's the feeling by the legislature right now that corrections officers are getting the very short end of the stick, and that's got to change. And obviously, as you can see what's happening, that seems to be the feeling of a lot of correction officers.
The upstate press secretary for the governor confirmed to Radio Catskill yesterday that there are more than 4,500 National Guard members on duty that were deployed to address this emergency, the state calls it, saying they're actively being deployed at correctional facilities across the state. Any indication from the county that there are National Guard troops in Sullivan County?
In Woodburn, yes.
There are. They have been deployed there?
Yep, they have been deployed there, yes.
And the other big news that we want to talk about is that closure of the PepsiCo snack facility that's here in Liberty, just down the road from us, in fact. Formerly known for most folks from around here called Ideal Snacks. They produce the Pop Corners brand. Mm-hmm. PepsiCo owns it now, announced that they're closing that facility, impacting about 300 jobs. What can you tell us from the legislature's point of view?
Well, the legislature and all of the county government's very concerned about this. First and foremost, about the people who work there and making sure that they see the opportunities and alternatives that they have in the county. Thankfully, Sullivan County has benefited from one of the, if not the highest job growth rate in the state for the past 3 years. So there are jobs out there. I've already been talking to our Center for Workforce Development and our local Chamber of Commerce that tell me there are businesses saying, we'll employ them, we'll employ them, we'll employ them. So, and if they need some retraining, that can happen as well. There's also the possibility that another snack manufacturer may come in. This happened before at that facility around 2007, 2008. This was before Pepsi and Frito-Lay owned it. But there was a layoff of about 300 people, and then another snack manufacturer came in and rehired most, if not all of them. So there are opportunities here because, of course, the big concern is if this property is allowed to just disappear and lie fallow, the impact in both employment and taxes and downtown business would be severe.
Well, and to that point, there are a lot of businesses in the Liberty downtown area that cater to some of the workers, many of whom are of Hispanic heritage, and, mm-hmm. and that would be a significant impact in the business community.
Yep.
So what you're hearing is from the business community, from folks rallying around a bit, saying, hey, we can try to help find some places for these folks to gain employment once this happens.
Yeah. A number of our folks and our partner agencies will be meeting with PepsiCo's leadership at that facility in the coming week and talking about what PepsiCo's plans are for the property. I know our Partnership for Economic Development stands ready to start marketing that property to other companies if PepsiCo is willing to either sell or rent or lease the property. We're not thinking that they want to just let it, as I said before, lie fallow. But that's the worst case scenario, and we have to operate with the thought that could happen. So I know, for example, our Center for Workforce Development right now and our legislators, including Louis Alvarez in particular, are working with the employees there to make sure that they have some place to land where they're going to get comparable salary and benefits. The real issue, though, is can we find that in the same downtown Liberty area, or will that be out of there? Because that's the concern, is that, as you said, downtown Liberty has these businesses which depend upon the workers from this plant. And if they are still in the area but relocated, say, to Monticello, Liberty still loses out there. And so we're trying to, on all fronts, make it work so that Liberty does not suffer unduly with this. Obviously, there's going to be an impact. There already are impacts happening. But our job is to try to – well, just the fact that people have their lives disrupted. I mean, if you know that by April or May you're going to be out of a job and you have to provide for your family, you're not going to wait till you're out of a job to start looking. And you may be making a change now. And we want to catch people before they decide they have to move out of the county to find other employment. We want to keep them here because it's important not just to Liberty but to Sullivan County for that local workforce to be here, skilled and unskilled. So we definitely are aggressively reaching out to these folks, many of whom, like Legislator Alvarez, knows personally, to make sure that they understand we're here for you. Let's talk and work together before you make any huge decisions.
One of the bigger employers in the county, the PepsiCo plant, mm-hmm. there's some economic fallout for the county as well. I mean, just overall, I mean, we're talking mm-hmm. about the workers, obviously, and their lives, but just how much of an impact is it to county revenues, county, impact there?
We haven't really tallied that up or calculated that. Right now, we're looking at it mostly from the perspective of the human impact. The financial impacts are yet to be seen, and they may not be that much in the end if taxes continued being paid even on a property that's not operating. You know, taxes are still being paid. But again, that's not really how we want to see things happen there. We want these people to be gainfully and fully employed so that they can raise their families here. Because if they leave, it's going to be more of an impact, for example, on the school district. There'll be less people to carry the tax burden, less students in the school. The village and the town will suffer. And the county, you know, they're all a component of Sullivan County, even if they aren't technically under county government. We're in this together. And I think the supervisor of the Town of Liberty, Frank DeMayo, said in the statement that we released, the joint statement, that this is going to take a united effort. But Sullivan County has come together before and made it through just this kind of situation, actually, and found success on the other side. So that is what we're aiming for. And right now, as I said, we're focusing on the human component of it to try to make sure that these folks have a place to go and people to talk to about what their next steps are going to be.
What was that situation that's similar?
I had talked about before, we're back in 2007, 2008, where 300 people were laid off at that facility. But then just a few weeks later, a new manufacturer came in and those people were rehired. That's the best case scenario. Don't know if that's going to happen here, but that's not the only outcome that could be considered successful for this. And we are already hard at work on making that happen. Center for Workforce Development, Community Resources, the Town and Village of Liberty, the Chamber of Commerce, the Partnership for Economic Development. We are all working together in lockstep on this.
Has PepsiCo given a timeline as to when they're planning to shut the doors?
The last of the layoffs, I believe, will happen at the end of May. So that's when we're assuming right around the end of May, beginning of June, that the doors would be shut and padlocked.
And they hadn't – it doesn't seem they've indicated that they're selling it. They're just closing it at this point.
Right. We don't know yet what their plans are for the disposition of the property. But I believe our Partnership for Economic Development folks will be meeting with them, if they haven't already, very shortly to find out, okay, what are your future plans with this? Are you looking to hold on to ownership but would be willing to rent or lease out the property? Are you looking to sell the property, or are you just continuing to hold on to the property? Obviously, if it's that latter one, if they're just going to hold on to the property and not really do much or demolish or whatever, we would argue, give us a chance. We think we could get somebody in there because it's ideally located. It's got plenty of water and sewer and electricity service for a plant of its size. So we think it could be a very attractive investment for perhaps another snack manufacturer.
We're speaking with Dan Hoos. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. The legislature also sending a letter requesting the reinstatement of the federal temporary protected status program. That's the program allowing non-Americans to remain in the U.S. because of danger back home. Is that being sent to the White House?
Yeah. We're sending that to Congress and to the president. I'll be putting that letter together today, actually. Specifically, the resolution passed by the legislature, the county legislature yesterday, says, whereas many Ukrainians have followed the process and have come here legally for protective status because of the war in Ukraine, and whereas the federal government has terminated their visas and the program in its entirety, and the legislature finds this to be outrageous and requests that it be reinstated. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the chair of the Sullivan County Legislature, on behalf of the legislature, is hereby authorized to sign a letter in support of this resolution. So our chair, for those who are not aware, is Nadia Rosh, who is a Ukrainian-American. She has a lot of ties back in Ukraine. I think she's visited there as well. And this is a big concern for her, is that these folks are left in a limbo, or even worse, may have to go back into a war zone. And so that is why we're going to be putting this letter together.
This is just specific to Ukrainian Americans?
No, the letter will mention the Ukrainian part of it, but it won't be specific to that, because there are other groups that are facing danger back in their home countries.
Well, and yesterday the Trump administration cut protections for hundreds of thousands of Haitians in the United States. Mm-hmm. There's upwards of 500,000 Haitians in the United States eligible for this temporary protected status. Previously targeted Venezuelans. It's part of this larger immigration crackdown from the administration. Does the legislature feel that taking this action will have an impact?
I don't think the legislature would take this action if they didn't think it would have an impact. I'm not necessarily sure they're thinking it will have a huge impact on the federal government per se. Hopefully some of our representatives will pay attention to it, but it will have, I think, a psychological benefit to the people who are dealing with this, that they understand that this legislature stands in solidarity with you, that you were here legally under a legal federal program, and now you're being left in limbo, and that's not fair, and that needs to be addressed properly with thought to the human beings involved in this. So that in itself is a benefit, even if they're still struggling through it, to know that you have people who are actively working on your behalf.
We've talked about the Ukrainian Americans and the relationship of the chairperson to that community. Have you heard from other communities who may be impacted by this temporary protection status?
I haven't directly. Legislators might have, but I'm sure this came out of what Nadia is hearing from the Ukrainian American community. But as I said, we know that there are more than just that ethnic group in Sullivan County, obviously. So the letter will reference them specifically, but will be all-encompassing.
Just before we move to another topic, on the Ukrainian Americans in the county and the chairperson's relationship to them, has there been any reaction to the administration's pivot on our relationship with Ukraine? Earlier in the week, the president calling the president of the Ukraine a dictator and that they started the war, which is not true.
Yeah, the chair Reich referenced that. I think you actually even had that on part of your program today, or at least I heard it on the radio today, I thought. If you listen to the beginning of, I think it was the executive committee yesterday, she made a statement about that the dictator is not the head of Ukraine, that she feels the dictator is the head of Russia, and that they have been the aggressors. She came out pretty strongly in that. Of course, the legislature for a while has had a Ukraine support flag that they've had in the legislative chambers. That may return to the chambers now if I have anything to guess about it. But she definitely, and I think the rest of the legislature too, feels that Ukraine is sort of like the corrections officers we talked about, getting the short end of the stick here. So
let's take a break. We'll come back with more from Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, including a few other resolutions that were passed in the legislature yesterday in Monticello. We'll find out more. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Ari Shapiro with NPR. If you've been thinking about helping this station with a contribution, but now is not the right time for a financial gift, you can donate a vehicle you don't need. Pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Think about it, and thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. We're talking with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government, as we do every Friday. Let's talk about a couple of resolutions passed yesterday at the legislature. Two resolutions passed to help plan for the opening of downstate casinos and some impacts. What would those impacts be? I think this is something that maybe folks may have forgotten about. There were permits issued for two downstate casinos, which could impact the one here, Resorts World in Monticello.
No, not could. It will. Mm-hmm. It's just a question of how much, and that we need to plan ahead for that and mitigate for that. We already have employed a lobbying firm to lobby for mitigation payments or other mitigation measures at the state level once these casinos open, because we do think that it is going to happen. But yesterday, the legislature unanimously agreed to continue a contract, actually amended a little bit, with the Partnership for Economic Development for the purpose of providing a strategic economic impact analysis, which would highlight ways in which the county would be most severely impacted by the award. And actually, this says it to three downstate licenses. I don't think it's two. I think it's three. Yeah. And the final report will assist the county in making the case to the Resort Gaming Facility Location Board, which is at the state level, that Sullivan County will encounter negative socioeconomic impacts as a result of the awarding of downstate gaming licenses, which will require mitigation. So that's, we're paying no more than $50,000 to the Partnership for Economic Development to create this strategic economic impact analysis, which will be one of those, what do they call them, white papers, the way to tell people this is what the impacts are going to be. This is a serious issue for a county that is nowhere near as wealthy as the downstate areas that are going to be getting these casinos. And then the other resolution that was passed was to authorize a contract with the local law firm of Billig, Laughlin, and Silver for legal services. The legislature desires to engage a law firm for the purposes of providing legal services to protect the interests of the county with respect to the issuance of three downstate casino licenses. And that amount is authorized to be up to $200,000 for attorneys to do what attorneys need to do with this.
And when we say downstate, down from us, but is one of them in Orange or no?
Orange has the Newburgh facility that is part of Resorts World.
One's
that's
in
like
the
a
city.
Downscale, but all three, I believe, are in the city.
Okay. And again, though, because this local casino here in Monticello is trying to attract people up from the city. If they can just go in their neighborhood, they won't get in the car or travel up.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island area, and the Yonkers area that are looking at full-fledged casinos. And, of course, there is a fair amount of traffic that does come up from the city, including by bus, to enjoy the amenities at Resorts World Catskills. And if that goes away, what kind of impact are we going to face, and how can we mitigate those impacts as best as possible? Obviously, you can't mitigate 100% of them. There are some people that are just not going to come up here because they'll have those casinos there. But how do we attract more folks from there? And, of course, this is something that we'll be working on with Resorts World as well, although since they're applying for one of the licenses down in the city, they have to focus more on that.
That's a tricky relationship.
It is, but I don't think they want to see their casino here suffer unduly because of that. And hopefully they're working that into their strategy too. But we have to really advocate for our folks here in Sullivan County, both those who work there and the local governments that depend upon the income that is generated from that facility.
Let's stick on tourism. A tourism sector enhancement grant program still under discussion. What's that program and what would that do?
Mm-hmm. This is a proposal that legislators have been looking at to use approximately $1.3 million in currently unused room tax money, money generated by tourism and tourists who come here. There was $1 million above and beyond that was given last year to the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, which has begun doling some of that out for what they're doing. But legislators have also talked about possibly in-house handling some of this, where they are thinking of attracting large-scale conventions or other big tourism events. Think, you know, the Bagel Festival size events that bring in tens of thousands of people. And how can they incentivize that, jumpstart that, get groups and organizations and businesses to start planning for such things and try to reclaim our status that we used to have as being sort of the convention capital of New York State years ago. I remember when the Fire Chiefs Convention used to come to the Concord, and you would have thousands of people from all over New York State coming here, and they liked coming here. And then, of course, there was no Concord anymore for them to come to, so they had to move elsewhere. So it's an idea, I hope, maybe to capture some of that. The disagreement on the legislature is the one that sort of has existed on other fronts as well, where, well, what about the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association? Why can't they be doing it? They can do this better than anybody else. And then other legislators saying, no, they've got some money to do with as they, we want to keep this in-house and try working on some of our own initiatives with that. So I don't know whether it'll pass or not. It's still, like I said, under debate and discussion. but it's an interesting concept that I certainly want people to be aware of and pay attention to.
There's a bill in front of the state legislature about reducing packaging waste. The Sullivan County legislature passed a resolution supporting that. What's that bill saying?
Yeah, this is a shout out to one of our local residents who brought this forward to the legislature. This is the value of engaging with your legislature. I think you've probably had her on here before, Rebecca Kreshkoff of Calicoon. She has come and talked to legislators about what she believes should be done about waste, not only locally but nationally. And one of the things that she talked about and put forward is we should support the state's Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. And I'm not even going to try to say it. I guess that PRIAH does have an acronym.
We love an acronym.
Oh, my gosh. At least the state does.
The state does.
So, as it's currently drafted, the intention is to reduce waste, increase recycling rates, create jobs, reduce toxicity in products, provide millions of dollars in savings for local governments and taxpayers with lower greenhouse gas emissions, basically by trying to reduce the amount of packaging. If you've ever gotten something mailed to you from one of the online retailers, you've probably been like me, like, did it really need that much packaging in it? I don't know that it did need all that. And a lot of that is not easily recyclable plastic or other materials. So the legislature has agreed to pass this resolution. They actually agreed to it yesterday to support the bill and have Governor Hochul sign it into law, along with an expanded and modernized bottle bill with the 5-cent deposit.
Another acronym we talked about last time you were here, that basic STAR exemption that might require renewal from some folks. Some folks may be a little alarmed about that, including myself. But you have some numbers here about how many people that might impact. It's just in Sullivan County.
Right. The state got in touch with us after we put out that press release because that alarmed them a little bit. And we were like, well, we need to let people know. We need to let people know. And they said, well, only about 220, 230 people in the county are going to be getting these letters, if they haven't already, to basically register with the state tax department to ensure they continue getting their basic STAR property tax exemption. I don't know exactly why these folks wouldn't have been registered in the past. It might have been something where they just went straight through their assessor rather than directly with the state. But this is something now you have to make sure that you're directly registered with the state for basic STAR. For your enhanced STAR, this doesn't affect you. If you are already getting a physical check in the mail as your STAR reimbursement, your STAR check, this doesn't affect you. Again, this is just for about 230 people, give or take, in Sullivan County who are getting these letters. But if you get this letter, make sure within 45 days that you register. Otherwise, you are not going to get your basic STAR exemption for this year.
And a few reminders, Snow NW Rail Trail event tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It starts, I believe, in Parksville at our Parksville Rail Trail. And it will go along one of the most beautiful sections of a rail trail that I don't know enough people know about. Everyone knows about the Hurleyville one. You know, that's nicely paved and it's right in the downtown. Well, Parksville, actually, it's right off Route 17. It's on the backside of the downtown there. And it goes along, I believe it's the Little Beaver Kill. And you see a waterfall back there. There's a cute little wooden bridge that you can go over. And yes, there's going to be some snow and some ice and all that other wonderful stuff. It's winter, but come with some proper footwear to enjoy, snowshoe or boots, maybe those ski poles that can help keep you upright, because we don't want anyone falling into the waterfall. Although I'm not even sure, the waterfall might be iced over, which makes it even more beautiful to see.
Well, tomorrow, sunny and a little warmer, high 31, so not so bad.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful event to do. It starts at 10:30 at 40 Main Street in Parksville. And it's really celebrating winter on our trails. It's a completely different experience than if you go during the warmer months on our trails. And I get it. It could be a little cold out, but I think actually the conditions tomorrow will be pretty perfect for a nice time.
We only have about a minute left, but I want to give you this opportunity to work in your pun. There's stories of local rock at the Sullivan County Museum. Did you enjoy that? But no role.
No role, just stories of Rob. Yes.
Instead of dad jokes, these are Dan jokes.
I am known for my dad Dan jokes at work. So it's just really cool. Some folks to be talking about those rock piles that people have in their backyards or have seen in the woods. Yeah. Some of them may be old stone walls. Others may have been put there by the glacier. But others may have actually been put there by Native Americans. Yeah. So this is going to be really interesting starting at 2 p.m. On Sunday at the County Museum in Hurleyville. There's going to be three people speaking about those potentially very ancient ritualistic relics that could be existing right under our noses.
Yeah, and we were able to talk to a few of them earlier this week. So
that's right, you did.
Good
you
reminder. Did. Mm-hmm. Dan Hoost, lots to get to today. Thank you so much for being here as every Friday you are, and we'll see you next Friday. Have a good weekend.
You too.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, closing the gap in local news coverage, we'll learn out how the River Reporter is trying to tackle that after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Science Friday, as federal scientists lose their jobs and science budgets are on the chopping block, some scientists are fighting back.
Destruction for the ill-conceived notions of cutting costs didn't put an American on the moon.
Plus, this winter has been more pathogen-packed than usual. We'll explain what's going on. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today, from 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
This week on This American Life. Not long ago, Zach's father called to warn him that the country's power grid was about to be wiped out.
I know, I know it sounds like conspiracy theory, but...
He believes a lot of conspiracy theories. Zach has trouble getting him to see the facts. And then, they figured out a way to settle their arguments once and for all. See eye to eye, have a shared reality. That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As part of its 50th anniversary celebration, the River Reporter is working to address one of its biggest challenges, finding enough staff to cover the extensive geographic area of its readership. In a new initiative aimed at enhancing that local news coverage gap, the River Reporter is launching its 2025 News Ambassador Program this spring. The program invites community members to volunteer their time and energy to help ensure that vital local government meetings are accessible to the public and adequately reported. Here to tell us more about the News Ambassador Program is the publisher of the River Reporter, Lori Stewart. Lori, good morning and happy 50th.
Oh, thank you, Tim. Thank you. And happy 35th to you.
Well, thank you. Yes. Tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind launching this News Ambassador Program at the River Reporter.
It is true what you say. The River Reporter covers 75 miles of the River Valley, not unlike both on Pennsylvania and New York, not unlike Radio Catskill's circulation area. And in that particular area, there's like 35 different meetings that in one sense need to be documented. And interestingly enough, a lot of them are happening all on the same night.
Yeah.
So that it's really Tuesday and Wednesday, second week of the month. At any rate, so we're looking to have this News Ambassador program, which is not a reporter. The News Ambassador would be a person who lives in the community who would agree to attend one town or township meeting a month to be a consistent presence there. We're looking to train the news ambassadors. Like, how do we listen objectively? How do we document what's going on? So we're asking news ambassadors to attend a meeting on a regular basis, to capture a recording of the meeting, and to fill out a brief form online, which would say, you know, a brief synopsis of the meeting, four or five sentences. What was the tenor? Was it full house, contentious, routine? Anything that you might say to your neighbor, like what happened at the meeting. And then we're going to develop a list of major issues, solar or infrastructure, sewer, water, land use, and have people fill out an online form where they're indicating what the town or township board dealt with that month. And then also, so what we're going to build online is an online repository of meetings, right? Just little synopsis and just these briefs, so that if somebody wanted to know, like, what were the solar projects that were going on, in the River Valley, they would be able to look and be able to search an online database that has a lot of those kinds of information that's bringing together the area as a region.
You mentioned that you're offering training that, you know, what some of the key responsibilities will be. You're also having this informational session coming up on the 27th, and that will give folks a little bit more of an idea of what you're looking for.
Yeah, it'll give us a more of an idea of what we're looking for. And we're looking to build a small team starting out, you know, that can help us prototype this. We're really using the concepts of design thinking. You know, this is the idea that, that we thought would be effective. We actually received a grant from Press Forward in order to move this, initiative forward. And we're going to be trying it out. We see it as a very, beneficial, and we see it as a very friendly, a friendly way for people to really be informed in terms of what is actually happening at our town and township meetings.
What are your hopes for the program, and where do you see it evolving in the years ahead? I mean, you're just starting it out, and it sounds like this great seed. How do you want to see it grow?
Well, I see it as has a few legs. You know, one is it's really, because it's a resident of a town going to a meeting, there is a certain relationship already. So what we're, you know, underlying, we want there to be, to kind of create a groundswell of people who are really looking for accurate local news dissemination. There's so much that can go on when people don't exactly know. So we're looking to form this real relationship between, you know, civic engagement in local issues, really putting the town and the township and the residents and the paper in a conversation together. We also think that it would be very supportive for the news ambassador, because there is so much misinformation that is out in the world, in our communities, and you don't necessarily know where to turn. And here you'll be able to turn, in one sense, to your neighbor. And that neighbor will be connected to other neighbors who are also interested in accurate local news dissemination in towns, you know, nearby. So to build a community of people who are really centering on how can we, like, help people become more civically engaged with our local community and the issues that we face here.
Yeah. How important do you think it is to have a community-driven initiative at a time like this, especially in our rural area?
I think it's really important. I think that there is a sense, I mean, at least for myself, that there's no controlling some of the bigger things that are going on, you know, in our nation, in the world. And if we can concentrate, if we can center our energies on our relationships within our communities, it just bolsters our resilience. Right. And it invites more people in to a sense of belonging, a sense of agency in our community. I think that that's so important, especially as some funding may be shifting. We need to be able to, as communities of communities, mm-hmm. you know, really be able to leverage our strengths and our relationships to really take care of our region.
That's Lori Stewart, the publisher of The River Reporter, talking about the new initiative, the News Ambassador Program. There's an informational session on how to become a River Reporter News Ambassador being held at the River Reporter offices in Narrowsburg on Thursday, February 27th at 7 to RSVP. Or for more information, you can email Lori, publisher at riverreporter.com, call the office, or go to riverreporter.com. Lori, thank you so much, and thanks for doing this. It seems like a really great initiative to help the community and keep local news alive and well.
Well, thank you for everything you do for local news and getting the word out.
You're welcome. All right. And staying in Narrowsburg, we're going to pivot now to an exhibit at the Ruft Graus Gallery. They're presenting Scene, Six Decades of Ralph Fasanella Paintings. Fasanella is one of America's most highly regarded self-taught artists, and this exhibit features work spanning six decades that chronicles peoples and events of post-war America in colorful, inventive, and socially engaging paintings. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Ryan Ward, owner and director of the Ruft Graus Gallery.
Good morning, Ryan, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, Valerie. Thanks for having me on.
I'm very happy to be interviewing you about the work of Ralph Fasanella. He is an outsider artist, and you have quite an extensive exhibit of his work at your gallery, the Ruft Graus Gallery in Narrowsburg, New York. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. There are really great things happening at the Ruft Graus. We have our winter exhibition. That's right. It's Ralph Fasanella, called Scene, Six Decades of Ralph Fasanella Paintings. And that is on view now through early April. And we have, in conjunction with the exhibition, highlighted works from Fasanella at the Outsider Art Fair at the end of February, along with some other terrific artists. But the Fasanella exhibition at the gallery is really something special because it highlights and features early work from the mid to late 1940s from Fasanella through about a year before his death in 1996 with a few paintings. So every decade is represented, and it's a wonderful cross-section of subject matter and painting approaches and styles, and you can really track his evolution through the years, and it's really a treat to view this show.
I'm sure that it is, because his work is very interesting and packed with information and color. He also had a very long history in the labor movement. He was active with the labor unions, part of the Bread and Roses strike, and many organizations that represented the working class.
That's right. He was the son of two Italian immigrants, and he was born in the Bronx and lived and was raised in all working class neighborhoods in New York City. Actually, his first job was on his father's ice truck delivering ice, and learned the value of hard work and helping those less fortunate. Those lessons were instilled in him through his parents especially. As a young man became politically active, was actually blacklisted at one point, as were many artists of that era. And then became very engaged with labor organizing, union organizing, especially in the United Electricians Union, but others, and that really became his life mission in many ways, and also he folded that right into painting when he took up painting in the mid 40s. He again is entirely self-taught, but did look at some of the master painters of the day, Picasso, Matisse, and others. he was really feeling his way through painting early on, which you can see in the exhibition with these terrific, expressive, colorful works from the 40s and 50s. And then he develops other great formal aspects and spaces in his work through the years. But throughout his painting career is that he's socially engaged. He's going out on the street. He's meeting people in union halls, in workplaces, in restaurants, in Nathan's Hot Dogs, in baseball stadiums, in the subways, and he's sketching them and he's painting them on site and then back in the studio. And he's making these works around sort of the everyday folks of New York City and the working class. And that's really what he built his life and work around. He was sort of an artist of the people and for the people.
Absolutely. And I found it interesting that he came to painting as a result of arthritis in 1945.
That's right. He was encouraged to try painting by a friend. And as I said, he did look at other painters of the time and the era, and really went unrecognized in terms of his work for many years. Then in right around 1972, was put on the cover of New York Magazine with the headline, "This Man Pumps Gas in the Bronx for a Living. Could he be the next Grandma Moses?" And so at that point, that was sort of his unveiling to the public in terms of what his art making was about, and continued to maintain, you know, blue collar jobs, created hundreds of paintings and drawings. In turn, in recent years, after his death in the late 90s, really has become widely celebrated, fortunately, and placed in a lot of major institutions and museums, Metropolitan Museum, American Folk Art Museum, Smithsonian, others, and many private collections. So again, this is really a great opportunity to see work that is not in those types of institutions and collections right in our little town of Narrowsburg.
Yes, it's really quite a coup to have the amount of work that you have right here in our little neighborhood.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it's not just for the serious collector. It's really a great opportunity for other enthusiasts and people that are just being introduced to Fasanelle's work to potentially own some of this work. And again, there's only a handful, you know, available through the gallery from all different time periods of his trajectory. And if nothing else, beyond viewing and enjoying the work and learning about his life and his work, it's an opportunity to possibly pull a piece of his into your collection.
Well, thank you so much for pulling this all together for us. And again, the Ruft Graus Gallery is in Narrowsburg, and the exhibit is on through
April 6th, with a closing reception April 5th from 5 to 8 p.m.
Okay. And we might want to add on that for those of folks that might be in the city this month, you are going to be at the Outsider Art Fair.
That's right. Highlighting some major works from Fasanella, along with some other terrific artists like Little Walt Dog from Los Angeles and Cindy Sullivan, also from California, in the space. At the Outsider Art Fair. That's February 27th through March 2nd at the Metropolitan Pavilion on 18th Street in New York City.
Well, thank you so much, Ryan, and we look forward to having you back to talk about your next big project.
Thank you so much, Valerie. I really appreciate it.
You are welcome.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi for that. Speaking to Ryan Ward, owner and director of the Ruft Graus Gallery. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, SullivanCatskills.com, Catskill Brewery, brewing ales, lagers, and mixed fermentation beers in a LEED Gold certified building, plus a food truck and beer garden at Exit 96 off Route 17 in Livingston Manor. CatskillBrewery.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, actor John Leguizamo tells us about his harshest critic.
And then she comes afterwards, oh, John, that was fantastic, but I didn't really like the punchline. It didn't really hit the way I thought it would hit. It didn't murder. And I was like, Mom, just be unconditionally loving for once.
I'm Peter Sagal. You will unconditionally love this week's news quiz with John Leguizamo, Mark Ronson, Billy Porter, and more. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, one more day of wind and cold and flurries, a high of 20, and tonight's low 10. Warming up, though, on the weekend, 31 Saturday, 33 Sunday. By Tuesday, we're going to hit 41 with a little rain. Go figure. On Point is coming up next from Boston. This is Radio Catskill.